10:20 a.m. February 2nd. Welcome to House Special Committee on Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism. Present this morning, Representative Tuck, Representative Keller, myself, Bob Heron, Representative Munoz, Representative Thompson, and Representative Gardner, and Co-Chair of Resources, Paul Seaton, will be sitting at the table with us. If you have a cell phone, please put it on silent or vibrate. The meeting today will end by 11:15, as the Northern Waters Task Force is going to have a press availability in this room at 11:30. So we have two people that will be presenting to us, and it's intent to move the committee, to move this resolution out of committee after we discuss it, and Wes Keller's going to, Representative Keller's going to offer up an amendment. So at this time, we'll start with our, we have two presentations, one by Brian Holst and one by Mark Myers. Brian, if you could please come forward, put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and begin your presentation to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Brian Holst. I'm the Director of the Juneau Economic Development Council.
Please go ahead.
Thank you for having me, Chairman Heron, and members of the committee. In addition to my role as the Director of the Economic Development Council here in Juneau, I am also actively involved in economic development issues throughout the state. Our organization is also very involved in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, support activities, cluster development, and technology transfer programs. I participated in the Institute of the North Policy Tour in Norway in August, September of 2011, alongside 40-plus other Alaskans. The Institute of the North had specific goals in organizing this policy tour, primarily looking at oil and gas industry in Norway, and identifying what lessons Alaska could derive from that experience. My motivation for attending was because my firm belief that while it is important for our state to look at diversifying our economy and strengthening sectors such as fisheries, mining, forestry, military, healthcare, tourism, renewable energy, marine trades, transportation, logistics, international trade, anyone interested in developing our economy must pay special attention to the oil industry. And here in Juneau, we are all very cognizant of the importance of the oil industry to our local economy. After growing up here in Juneau and then attending college outside, from 1988 through the end of 2007, I worked abroad in various countries and in economic and community development, living mostly in South America, Central America, and Eastern Europe. I had the opportunity to work in over 20 countries, including in Asia and Africa as well. I've had the chance to visit a similar number more. As a state, a nation, and a people, we have a lot to share with others. I've also learned that there's a lot that can be gained from other experiences. And I went to Norway with the perspective to understand how they operate and what makes them successful economically. Norway is rich, prosperous, and competitive. They're ranked in the top 10 to 15 countries worldwide in terms of global competitiveness. We are similarly ranked. In fact, we're ranked in the top 5 consistently. In 2010, the per capita income in Norway is higher than it is in Alaska and in the United States. They have a low unemployment rate of about 3%. They have a generous state-supported retirement system. They have universal medical care. Education of 15-year-olds, they rank ahead of us in math and reading, and they're tied for us in science performance. In postgraduate education, 36% of the residents of Norway have postgraduate degrees, and that compares to about 10% of U.S. citizens or 9% of Alaskans. On the trip, we gained many insights into what drives their success in general terms, and oil and gas is certainly a major factor in their success and how they handle it. They have over 14 times the resources saved in the equivalent of their permanent fund, $573 billion at the end of 2011. And with 4 times the oil production of Alaska, they have about 10 times the number of jobs in the oil extraction production services industry. What really underlines much of what the Norway model is how they, as a democratic and capitalist society, deal with the question of the role of government in the economy. And I know that that's front and center in the discussions here in Alaska as well. Much of the elements of the Norway model, which I can describe as observations, are a result of their answer to that question. I'm not an expert on oil and gas nor on Norway. I want to share with you some of my observations from the trip to Norway, specifically regarding oil and gas, with a previous caveat that I'm no expert in these. They share a similar attitude that we have here in Alaska about the ownership of the resource, that the oil and gas is for the people of Norway and the people of Alaska. They have same levels of taxation for both oil and gas. They have a corporate tax, and then they have a 50% resource tax. They tax only on profits in Norway. Their tax regime is stable. They claim no changes, no significant changes for the last 17 to 19 years. They phased out their royalty system. They want to align taxation with the profits of the company. They claim a great alignment. We heard this over and over again, alignment of the interests of the industry with the interests of the state. And they also claim to capture, well, they capture 80 to 85% of the value of the oil and gas that is commercialized when you take into consideration their direct investments. They've gone from an application process versus a bidding on leases, which is the way we operate here in Alaska. They limited bidding on leases to forgo that income for a commitment to explore and develop resources. The licensing, and I know we're going to have an expert on this later, so I won't go into areas where I'm not an expert, but just to mention these areas. They claim that the licensing is, they expect production within the next three to six years, and they claim that this avoids companies sitting on leases that they own and effectively holding on a reserve and not allowing access to those reserves. The direct engagement of the industry is for a dual purpose. It builds capacity within the country, and it maximizes the financial return to Norway. We see very high levels of employment in the industry in Norway. And we also see that Norway has become an expert in oil and gas. The oil and gas support services industry is the number two export of the country of Norway. They claim a high degree of expertise in the oil and gas sector at both the government and private sector, and that in large part they claim to the ability to investments they make and the ability to bring people from the regulators into the industry and vice versa. The state direct foreign financial investment, they invest directly into fields. This leads to smaller operators having access to capital. There are 60-plus international firms operating in Norway. It also leads to greater knowledge of the industry by regulators and policymakers. Their rationale is that the state direct financial interest produces more income because it allows for less risk to be taken by companies and therefore less cost for the company to invest and produce oil. The more investment that Norway makes, the more production there is and the greater income there is to Norway. I found it very interesting that the gas and oil lines are treated as a utility. They have a regulated return of about 7%. And they found that that alignment of the oil and gas lines to move away from oil industry, where they have higher need for higher returns based on the models that they use as an industry, and they found that the ownership is now typically insurance companies and other investors, longer term investments, treating it as a utility. And also very compelling was the support activities that the oil and gas industry, the government is engaged in support of the industry, including seismic testing. The environmental and other approvals are included at the time of licensing, and they claim a faster process. Some of these things are hard for me to know how quickly they occur or don't occur. In striking was the, I think was very valuable, was the understanding that 99.9% of the oil and gas production is offshore, and it's moving further north. We had an opportunity to go far north and see a completely underwater facility, which they claim to be part of the answer to dealing with ice flows, which I think will have something very important for us to follow and watch to see the application for Alaska. Not regarding some brief observations regarding other elements of the economy. Norway embraces very much their role as an Arctic nation and the potential in the Arctic for trade and communication as well. We're above the Arctic Circle at the University of Tromsø, and the Gulf Stream does magic there. I'm not sure it's a fair comparison. And I know that tonight there's an Arctic Forum here in Juneau. That I know there's a lot of interest in our role as an Arctic nation. Norwegians pay income tax. There's a commitment to equity in energy costs across the nation, considerable investment in renewable energy. 95% of the energy consumption is renewable. Similarly to the attitude that they took to the oil and gas industry, they've taken with the renewable energy industry, and Norway is an exporter of technologies in the alternative and renewable energy sector. They have a high investment in education, higher per capita GDP than we do, which shows a clear correlation between high levels of academic achievement and high levels of prosperity. And again, the number, building this expertise, the number two industry in Norway is the oil and gas support services, not just the oil and gas extraction. And so finally, the question that underlies much of the Norway model is how they answer the question of the role of government in supporting the economy. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Question is, of course, I was on the trip as well, but two questions. First one is, what surprised you on the tour? And the second question, what disappointed you?
I think what surprised me was the level of investment by the government sector and the correlation to the level of investment by the private sector. I actually went very skeptical. I was told by many that the Norway model doesn't apply to Alaska. There's no way it would ever work. I'm not saying that it necessarily will work, but I was very pleased with the very impressed, very surprised by their claims for extremely high levels of investment. You saw the number of firms that participate. You saw the incredible high returns, and you heard about a high level of stability. I recall one of the questions at the Parliament where somebody asked, you know, what is the attitude of the oil and gas industry about this high level of taxation? And, of course, they said, oh, of course, they would rather have lower taxes, but we anticipate that. So that high level, that actually seemed, that model seems to work well and compatible with the private sector, surprised me. In terms of what disappointed me, of course, I'm not a fan of farm fishing. I want to say that for the record. And I think we also were vindicated a little bit when we put the poor guys on the spot when they were exporting. What were they exporting to Chile? And the poor Chilean industry was affected by that. So it seems that. I won't comment any further. That was
all right. Other questions?
Hi, Representative
Munoz.
Thank you, Brian. One question I have is in regard to the permitting. The Norwegian model, the state makes considerable investment on the front end, but then there's almost guaranteed permitting period of time of up to, say, two years, more or less. But in Alaska, it's much more unclear what that permitting time frame can be. And if the state were to invest so much more on the front end, then, I mean, in our situation, it's so much different because of that big unknown with the federal government. If you could just address that.
Yeah.
Please, go ahead, Brian.
Through the chair. I'm not an expert on oil and gas and how that would work. It seems, though, that what my understanding is the initial groundwork prior to the licenses being given, the application process that they go through, which is very much directed by the government clearly indicates this is a this is an area that we want to explore in, and they have a my understanding was that they go in there with a high understanding of the likelihood that they indeed intend to provide licenses in these areas, and they were and they talked about how they would, if they weren't successful in giving licenses in those areas, they would continue to go back to those areas until they found a an investor that was interested in investing in those areas. So I know that doesn't answer directly the question of the regulations, which is beyond my capacity here, but it seemed to be the deliberateness and the planning is that it aligned well where they went into it thinking that they were indeed going to provide those permits. And it's also, we were talking federal versus state, and I think here we have to remember that we're only a state, and there they've got they're able to manage the entire permitting process themselves.
Other questions of Brian? Representative Foster, and for the record, Representative Foster joined us at 10:25.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that there are some things that may not be well suited for adaptation by those of us here in Alaska. Do you have a top two or three things that could be adopted here based on the Norway model?
Again, with the caveat of me not being an expert in the oil and gas industry, the access of getting the resource through the chair, I apologize.
Please go ahead.
The access of getting the resource from the production to the markets struck me as extremely valuable. That the Norwegians invest in that infrastructure to bring the oil and gas lines to bring that resource to market. That seems to be, and they do it at a very relatively low cost, very well regulated. That seemed to be something that would be consistent with not a big stretch for Alaskans. And if you ask me for two, I think the second would be, I think the scope of this direct investment, strategic direct investment, produces a lot of benefits. One of which is the transparency that I think that people in Alaska are very interested in, and you are, in terms of being able to answer that question: are we being fair to the oil companies that are so important to the economy of the state? And by making those co-investments, it seems that for smaller operators, it reduces the risk, reduces the outlay of capital into to allow them to be able to make to access a resource. It allows us to have more control over accessing that resource. It would seem to me to be within reach of something that could be attempted here in Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we go to the Chancellor, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have to go to another meeting, but I did want to inform the committee that in House Resources, we're looking at incentivizing some other basins, and one of the things that we're looking at is, should that just be credits, or should we be looking at state direct financial interest and that model to get there? So there's I just wanted to let you know that there, from the Norway tour, which I was on, and you were, and several other folks, that there were some lessons learned to at least to attempt to apply, and I think that I just wanted to share with you that some of those things are being looked at throughout the bills that are going through our committee. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sorry I have to leave.
Okay. All right, Chancellor, you please come forward. Chancellor Myers, put yourself on the record and your affiliation, of course, and then your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Myers. I'm the Vice Chancellor of Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Maybe appropriate to give a little bit of my background, because the views I'm representing really aren't the university's. They're just my own observations. And I was asked to comment on what parts of the Norwegian model might be applicable to Alaska. And in my experience in Alaska, I started here about 27 years of oil and gas experience in various forms in Alaska, and some outside industry experience as well. I started out as a petroleum exploration geologist for one of the major companies up here. worked in some of the major basins, worked early development of the Kuparik River oil field, later worked exploration for some of the major satellite finds that were happened on the North Slope, been able to do geologic field work across the North Slope, et cetera. I also worked for the state government, including 5 years as director of oil and gas for the state, and I was a state geologist, and then director of the United States Geological Survey. And in that role, I really got a good look at international models. We have 9,000 employees, 400 locations. I think the biggest splash in recent history in terms of resource potential was the 2008 Circumarctic Resource Assessment that USGS did. In fact, the Norwegians quoted in their literature as the definitive source of potential in the Arctic, and I was director of the survey when that was accomplished. In my current role, I'm really focused in on the research potential, and I think one thing the Norwegians do, and I've worked with SINTEF and met with SINTEF and some of the other key research institutions, they invest a significant amount both in private and in university level research, which really helps them. In my background, I actually figured out I worked for 6 different governors in various capacities in the state, and so I've seen a lot of different approaches and styles. I'm going to make some general comments about, when I talk about adaptability, some of the challenges the state has too, and it's not aimed at a specific governor or administration, but it's a general observation over time of some of the challenges we have in the state, and that's important to see what we could probably do from the Norwegian model and what might be more challenging for us to do. So if I want to start out, I think, again, the committee's done a wonderful job, and I did not go, in full disclosure, I did not go to Norway on the trip with you, but it sounds like you had a great tour in terms of learning a lot of good information about how they intelligently manage their resources. And I think one thing that's very clear in their model is they have created a four-legged stool. So they're not dependent on any one major component, but they keep a significant tax structure, and that provides a base of revenue. They own 67% of one of the world's major oil companies, Statoil. So majority ownership in Statoil gives the Norwegian government an immense say into how that company behaves and acts and how it manages. It also allows them to have a fully integrated major oil company to use as a technical base. Their state direct financial interest is something they do when they issue their licenses to get the opportunity. So they have basically their own investment firm that can strategically invest. And then finally, they have a very very well-educated, very professional staff in the Petroleum and Energy Ministry. So they have really thought through and worked through an integrated system all the way from the regulators to a commercial entity, which they have the majority stakeholder, to an investment firm, and then finally to a base tax structure. So when we look at their model, it's very careful to understand that those four components are there because they balance them. They make it stronger, and they help maximize. Pull out one or two of those legs of the stool, and you'd have a fairly unstable structure. So when you look at Norway, it's very important that when we look at our models that we don't cherry-pick little pieces out of there because it suits a particular ideology, that we look at it more holistically. Again, I mentioned Statoil. One of the major reasons they have that stakeholder ownership is to make sure that Statoil protects the interests of Norway. And you know they have international operations. They truly need to be international in the scale of that company. But fundamentally, they still come back. They employ Norwegians. They developed in Norwegian. The ownership and the infrastructure that was mentioned is extremely important. One of the challenges you have, if you look on our map on the North Slope, we have one pipeline. One infrastructure corridor. We have a couple of large infrastructure components with some big satellites like Alpine. Those infrastructure components, facility access of other parties trying to develop in those areas is a big challenge. And you've seen that with folks like ENI developing entirely independent facilities because they can't negotiate what they consider a fair rate for facility access. You can't blame the owners, on the other hand. They're trying to maximize profit. It's just a natural tension that exists within our system as it is. And Norwegians have solved that. By both taking equity share and by having stronger facility access regulations and structure. In the North Sea, for example, the British did something similar. They created the North Sea Code of Practice that allows arbitration in the case of facility disputes between parties. We have no mechanism, really, to intervene in negotiations between parties, yet we have a critical interest to see the infrastructure used to its capacity. So again, nothing disingenuous or evil about this. This is natural tension that exists that the Norwegians have solved and we have not in our system. And various models exist out there. The Norwegians have, I think, a pretty effective model. If we look at the Alaska model, you know, I read a lot of concerns that the Alaska model had failed. The Alaska really relied on the nature of competition in the early days. If you think about it, you had a lot of different major oil companies on the North Slope. That competition led to highest bidder on competitive leasing. So leasing works well where you have a fully competitive market and a lot of interest, enough parties to build critical mass so you have true competition. And to do that, you have to have a relatively level, even playing field. A company that feels severely disadvantaged in information or facilities or capacity or market simply will not come and invest the same way as a company that has a more integrated approach, has a higher profit margin on the same play. Give you an example, you see Shell coming in not on the small plays but in the OCS because they believe they can build enough critical infrastructure on their own to make their projects viable and need a certain level of critical mass. So again, this idea of competition in our system actually worked fairly well in the early days prior to the development, but once we got the major infrastructure and the companies merged and there were less major oil companies, our competition has decreased dramatically. So we're not seeing the same level of competition, and that's problematic for the design of our system. There are many historical parallels to that, whether you look at fur trading way back when, timber, fishing, minerals, it's typical. So the Norwegian model recognizes that, and it provides some solutions to that in a more governmental manner. And so they then designed a very intelligent situation. You know, I will say, again, one of the push-pulls we have, and again, I think those parallels to history in Alaska is why the Alaska Constitution is so strong on maximum benefit to the people of Alaska, concerns over that. So again, as we look at structures, I think what we could apply to Alaska depends on the outcomes Alaska wants to achieve. There's lots of good goals out there. Some of the goals are very short-term, some are much longer-term. And how do you balance that? It's clearly Norway is taking a long-term view of building a very stable base of governmental support under their structure, but they also you do it to sustain and increase revenue to their government over a long period of time. So it's a very intelligent approach, as we mentioned, all the way from graduate education to the integration of the four legs of the stool. So Alaska, again, I think, has a hard time defining those goals. And until you can define those goals, it's very difficult to design a new structure. So I'll just throw out some of the goals that I've heard out there. One is revenue. You know, the state needs revenue, pure and simple. But revenue has a lot of different components to it. One is, are you looking for new sources? So are you going to invest in pipelines? Are you going to invest in alternative energy? Are you going to invest in various sources? Are you going to invest for stabilized rate of production rather than a rapid ramp-up, short-term ramp-up? So you have a rate versus maximization issue. You know, for example, you can very quickly blow down oil fields, lose a lot of production, but increase rate. Now, most oil companies don't do that. We have an Oil and Gas Conservation Commission and DNR to assure that that doesn't happen, that there's conservation of, but you could do it. So rate isn't necessarily always what you want. You may say, I want to defer it, but I want a more stable production base over a longer period of time. So there's just a question there. You know, when you do your analysis, say, of tax structure or of these elements, are you after rate acceleration or are you after maximization of recovery of resources? And over what time frame? Jobs for Alaskans is a big deal in Alaska. You know, the best way to get jobs for Alaskans is to have trained Alaskans able to do the most complex jobs in the oil field. So the companies, when they have surges, don't have to import people. Do you want to be able to export people, as Norway has done through Statoil? They're experts. I will say, as far as I can tell, the head of ConocoPhillips in Alaska is a Norwegian. And, you know, they are experts worldwide. Do we want to do that? Do we want to have that capacity? Well, it takes greater investment in education. Do we want to be state-of-the-art in research? Well, a certain amount of that research could be done here in Alaska if we chose to. So these are fundamental decisions as to what sort of jobs we want, when we want them, and do we want to invest in the infrastructure to create the jobs or prepare Alaskans for those jobs, rather than simply, you know, create an opportunity for jobs that can be filled by people from outside of Alaska. Affordable energy for Alaska is a big one, is a big issue for us. You know, how do we blend export of energy and the revenue source to input? I see a lot of confusion in that over our various multiple gas line proposals. You know, what is the primary goal of the gas line, and then how do we maximize and balance those issues? Norway has looked at that with their investment in hydro energy. That's their way of approaching it. We have many ways we could approach it. if we choose to, but I have not heard any consistency in terms of approach of the state or desire to have that approach. So I think clarifying that's really important to what structure you set up and to state ownership in whatever infrastructure you choose to buy. Value-added products and diversification. Again, Norway is pretty intelligent about developing the intellectual capital and capability for value-added. We pretty much do not do a lot of that. We do some local refining for local needs, but we don't have a petrochemical industry. We have opportunities. You can look at the various opportunities, and some will pencil out and some won't. But how do we diversify that energy source? It could be as simple as going to more hydro energy, hydro-supported electrical energy and export more natural gas, for example. We have choices. Out of Cook Inlet is a simple example of that. So Norway is a world-class leader in workforce development. That can be used very much for expanding and developing industry in Alaska. I mentioned stability and revenue. One of our challenges, I would say, is philosophically, the question you were asking, what should government do? What's appropriate? We have wide-ranging philosophical debates that are based in belief structure, not necessarily in practicality. So when you work through these structures, there are real implications. If you have a state agency building a major multi-billion dollar gas line, you are in the gas line business. You have chosen to do a public sector project. You may transfer that over to the private sector, but you have made a choice at that point. So we make these choices, but we rhetorically talk about them as simple transfers or other things. So the state, in my opinion, needs to clarify what it really wants in terms of infrastructure development and what its role is in that infrastructure development, whether it be in the pipelines, the downstream, or whether it even be in the field investment upstream. Then finally, you know, there's a philosophical debate about who drives our investment in oil and gas and our strategic planning up here. Is it the industry? Is it the administration? Is it the legislature? Is it the federal government? And then how are those roles meshed? And Norway, again, you look at their model. Their model has basically answered those questions and harmonized those forces. I would say our forces are very much not harmonized in that area, and that affects us. So with those challenges, what are some of the things we could do? So basically, I think Alaska could look at broadening its stool. It could look at direct investment. It could look, and particularly as Representative Seaton talked about, in areas where there's no infrastructure and you're starting with a clean slate, it could be a driver of investment. Whether that's through credits or whether it's through direct investment really is a series of options. Investing in existing infrastructure, and in the past it's been proposed under the Stranded Gas Act, for example, the state transfer its taxes and royalties both in terms to an equity interest in the field, basically X amount of gas. And one of the challenges with that is the state really didn't have a good way to evaluate what that's truly worth. And, of course, the companies have varying opinions, but they have far superior capacity and data. And then there's the pure negotiation. Even if you think it's worth X and you could technically show it, it doesn't mean a willing seller would agree to sell it to you for X. So when you start trying to convert resource value, you have a real challenge on your hand of value to whom, to how much. What's the existing infrastructure and facilities worth? What's reasonable facility fees? How can you guarantee if you buy X capacity in a pipeline, you can fill it if you don't have an exploration company, if you don't have a Statoil or development company? So the linkages here are really important to understand when we look at any of the options. If you were to do it, it's a lot easier to do it in a new frontier basin. On the converse, if you want to do it on the North Slope, one opportunity might be, provided it's not too late, is to put an equity interest in a field like Point Thompson. It's yet to be developed, has key infrastructure to link the eastern side of the North Slope near the Anwar border to the main infrastructure. There's a huge opportunity there for an Alpine-type satellite development that could lead to significant other exploration and development done right. So there are cases, even on the North Slope, where you might do it. You want to make sure that you had the data and you could professionally manage it, and you would have a minority interest. But there's an area where you might push it over to get a gas cycling project up to 50,000 barrels per day and spur it over into that. So there are some options to do it. Much harder to do it in the existing infrastructure. One of the other challenges is the reclamation costs on the North Slope for both taps and for the facilities will be significant. It's not bonded for. It's based on parent company guarantees, and the state would have to account in the negotiations of if it bought it, how it was going to handle its responsibility in terms of the abandonment costs, which are a huge liability right now. And there's no funding bank for it. So it would have to discount whatever it offered based on those future costs. And that will be a major challenge and sticking point. I'm getting very specific just because I want to express to you how complicated this really is. But there is, again, a fair amount of merit if the state levelizes and stabilizes its tools. And one last comment is the investment in research and development. Now, I'm in that business now, but the reality is the state could do a lot of upfront loading. It could acquire data we know is going to be needed in permitting, general data on water on the North Slope, ecosystems data, habitat data. So we're ahead of the curve so that when it comes to permit it, there's actually good public data sets that the federal permitting agencies will accept in that process. That could save us years on projects. We have to solve issues of water. The future North Slope, whether it be a freshwater flood of the major fields like Prudhoe, whether it be shale oil, is going to require a significant amount of fresh water. And we're going to have to think about how we're going to acquire that environmentally on an area that's basically a desert in terms of the amount of rainfall. Now, there are ways to manufacture catchment systems. There's lots of clever ideas. Surface access. When we start looking at things like shale and news, it's immensely intensive with surface infrastructure. We need to find out how to move rigs across that, how to get acceptable surface access that will be environmentally permittable on the large scale. And the state should be and is in the governor's budget. I actually have an item in there for the Department of Natural Resources. Finally, I do not believe the companies in the state and the state are really employing the latest and greatest technology that's being developed elsewhere. We're not capturing it well enough. You look at the shale oil, you know, we have some of the highest organic shales in the world sitting on the North Slope, yet we're far behind North Dakota in terms of its development. And that's an issue of not bringing the technology. We haven't even tested it. So we haven't gotten fundamental data out there. Salt company, and thank goodness for an inventive company coming in saying, hey, we need to think about this, able to buy the leases and move it forward. But, you know, where were we? You know, where were we in Alaska not thinking about it? Why didn't we get there when 2 years ago it became readily apparent the Bakken was exploding and the technology that was being used for shale gas was very usable for shale oil? So there is certainly clearly, in my mind, a role for increased investment in research and development. Norwegians didn't do that very well. Combined with education, I think makes an effective combination. So. Mr. Chairman, thank you. With that, I'll close off my remarks.
Okay. Chancellor, do you have your testimony in written form for the report?
I do not. I have some notes.
Recording secretaries don't mind notes if you can get a copy of them.
Sure.
Okay. Questions from committee members? Representative Tuck? Representative Gardner after that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the presentation. I also appreciate the previous presentation as well and showing the differences. And I think one of the things that we see is government's role, taking an active role and making sure that the development does benefit as many people as possible. And there's this attitude that, you know, government gets in the way of things. Government needs to be removed. And when you talked about shale oil and gas development, was there specific things that North Dakota did that helped foster it along, or was it the industry that decided to apply it? Because that's where I'm having a hard time right there, because here in the state, you know, we've relied on the industry to advance technologies. What can we do outside of being an active partner in the oil industry? How is it that we can start implementing or utilizing those technologies?
Representative Tuck, through the chair. In the case of the Bakken, it was a combination of several factors. The first thing was a recognition of the resource. It goes back a long time ago, but there's a USGS researcher kept pounding the table to say the resource in the Bakken's huge. And he put out some numbers, and unfortunately, before he finished the report, he died. And so his report was kind of sort of out there. North Dakota wanted it out there. There were certain there were incentives for the USGS to complete the evaluation. So we went back in and we did an evaluation, which led to the 3.2 billion barrel estimate. At the same time, the industry was starting to move into the development stage. So the numbers that were put out there were actually based on actual production drilling. So we knew the rates of decline, and we knew the technology being employed, and there was enough to be able to create good production curves. So we could take the in-place numbers and get to a technically economically recoverable numbers. At that same time, then, the industry in North Dakota has roads every section. So you have infrastructure and roads, it was largely driven by smaller companies that came in there. It wasn't the major oil companies that drew this revolution. There's also the ability to truck oil out, and there were pipeline oil infrastructure pipelines. So again, better infrastructure, better access, lower cost of delivery, because you could simply, you know, small companies could play. Very complex lease situation. Almost all it's under private ownership. Risk-taking. The risk-taking was being taken by these companies, and, you know, if the oil prices had fallen to $60 a barrel, they'd have been in deep trouble. But they didn't. They went up to 100 and kind of stabilized. So we had higher prices, emerging technology, a basin that was open to a lot of different players, new public awareness of the resource. I think it was a combination of that. And North Dakota has sufficient water supplies, I would say, as well, for the hydraulic fracking. The next phase, of course, will be connecting the gas pipelines, because they're producing a fair amount of gas along with the oil. Very challenging. When I first looked at the data, I was challenged by it. We were seeing rate wells about 1,000 barrels a day declining rapidly to 100. I think 12,000-foot horizontals, how are they making this work? You know, so at $60 oil, they'd been right at the bubble. But at $100 oil, they've been really able to make it work. And once it expands, their technology gets better. Again, if you look at the number of companies drilling in North Dakota, the open competitive model's working, largely because of they're not that far away from the market. They have full-year drilling, and they have infrastructure.
And follow up.
Mr. Chair.
Please, go ahead.
And so just based on what you just last said, you also said that the free competition openness really benefited us when we first began in the oil industry up here. So do you see that North Dakota taking a different route eventually as they get into production due to the fact that then all the competition kind of gets eliminated or gets absorbed into the hands of a few?
Well, I think, Representative Tuck to the chair, my opinion is that it's broad enough base, and the individual leaseholders and the leases are small enough that we're not likely to see that merger to a few smaller companies unless you see a very low stress price and these guys don't have cash flow, have to sell out. But if oil prices stay high, I think we will see a pretty robust industry there. I do think we'll see majors come in and buy some of these guys out, but I don't think all of them. It's sort of like shale gas. They'll still be widely owned over a fairly broad part of the community. What really will hold them up there is the price of oil stays high enough to make a good profit on it, it seems to. So I don't think they'll have the same issues. Again, they don't have the long-haul pipelines. You can always truck oil out if you want as well. So they have lots of options. We're relying on existing infrastructure. Our minimum economic field size is much larger. But the shale oil play certainly is exciting in Alaska when you look at the rocks and the potential. We just simply haven't drilled the wells to know if it works. If it does work, then we have massive amounts of potential. But it's a manufacturing process. You've got to drill wells continuously year-round. You have to have surface access, and you have to have water.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Your presentation is really interesting. But I feel like there's an elephant in the room, and that is the role of taxes. So can you speak to that a little bit? Because when you've talked about what's happening in North Dakota and the reasons that it's been such a, you know, just caught on and it's been so intense in the development, but what we hear from Alaskan industry is that it's because taxes are low. And can you speak to that?
We need to have real analysis of what the profitability in Alaska is or isn't. You need to be able to benchmark it with real data in terms of real rates of return. You can't look at nominal tax structure. You have to look at real tax structure, including incentives. You have to look at the real federal rate that the companies are paying rather than the nominal 35%. So you have to do in-depth analysis, and I've not seen that analysis yet. So I can't tell you what the profit margin is in North Dakota versus the profit margin is here on an equivalent field. It's true we have higher costs for development. We also have a massive reserve base. We have a single landowner covering many, many pieces of it. So The other piece is the royalty piece matters a lot. I suspect there's very few 12.5% royalty leases in North Dakota. So you have to factor in the state as a landowner is taking two bites, one in royalty and one in taxes, but it's lumped together. So you need to find out, again, the tax-specific, tax-to-tax comparison. The other thing is with the incentives for development, and if you have a capital-intensive development project, as shale oil is, as is shale gas, the credits in Alaska are immense. So you can't just compare it to existing tax rate on a field that's not having any new additional investment or very minimal investment. You have to compare it against a field that's actively being built. And if you look at shale oil, for example, our structure is probably very favorable to it, probably more favorable in North Dakota, I would argue, for that particular issue. So if you look again at that tax structure, it's higher in Prudhoe Bay from existing relatively high productive wells. So again, apples-to-apples comparisons have to be made. The data isn't there. I will say, also, as you've seen oil and gas develop in states, it's very common for states to pass a severance tax following successful production and development. So in many states, you see the history of the tax structure actually going up once production is well established. So again, the rate you start out with and the rate you end up with is often very different. And so you have to look at, again, the evolution of tax structure over time. But I will say fundamentally, I can't make that comparison for you because the data simply, I believe, is not out there in the public to make it with.
Okay. Take care. We've got two more questions, and we're going to wrap it up at 11:15, but I want to take action on the bill, the resolution. Representative Thompson, then Representative Foster.
I was just going to mention that there is a lunch and learn today. Vice Chancellor, you're leading, and it's on research and the properties of trying to develop that. Are we doing a lot of research now, like in heavy oil areas and things like that?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, we're doing some. I'd like to do a lot more. I think, again, that issue of the front-end loading the data sets and the information so that you shorten the permitting time, so that you look at key technological hurdles, so that when the state does choose to make an investment in the infrastructure and it has five choices, it can sort out which choice brings what benefits and which benefits it doesn't bring, which projects have more risks than others. So again, that the state can make intelligent investment, that's a big part of this. It takes information and data. And I do believe that through research, the university has the capacity to do a lot more than it's doing. And there's some exciting new technological changes. I look at it as we live in a very rich land. The resource base in Alaska is almost unimaginable. Yet we're not capitalizing on it. And I think there are approaches that could be tried that are very different. And I commend the committee again for looking at the Norwegian model as an example. But in the research side, I believe we can show some examples of some exciting opportunities.
Thank you. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that in order for us to determine what our structure is going to be, we have to determine what our goal is going to be. And is that goal going to be we're going to maximize revenue, or are we going to go for the quick ramp up or sustained maximization? Are we going to go for jobs and so forth? And so I'm sitting here thinking there's 61 of us in this building here, and we've all got different ideas on how we get there. At one time, Norway was faced with the same dilemma. How did they achieve consensus? And maybe this is something that a whole lunch and learn hour could be spent on, but I don't know if you could give us a couple thoughts on that.
I don't, President Foster, to the chair, I don't pretend to be a real expert on the Norwegian psyche, but the reality is they start out again to build a long-term sustainable series of long-term sustainable goals. They recognize, and you can read it in the fact sheets you guys had on Statoil and their investment fund, how clearly they link societal benefit and societal goals into it, how clearly they link sustainability of the resources, sustainability, environment, and balance into their structure, and how clearly they understood the integration all the way from the pre-exploration work all the way through the refined product, delivery and refining the product. So they really took, I believe they took it on, but they started out with a very different mindset, very much in alignment. They also have been successful at depoliticizing their oil and gas industry, I think more than we have. Just an observation, again, personal observation, that they have a much higher level of professional engineers, geoscientists, economists, commercial analysts, et cetera, in their structure, and that helps them craft it better. I think they also tend to insulate their civil service better. You know, our technical experts are largely have to be by the nature of the jobs, political appointees, and that limits the job pool down sometimes fairly significantly. So again, we have not necessarily built the same structure to the point where you can have a more of alignment on the debate in terms of the goals of the state. And I think it's something the state should consider. I do think, in fairness, I hear a lot of this discussion. And in fact, the other that you went to NORA, look at other models, means that you're really trying to dissect this into pieces. The challenge is it's very, very complex. And if you aren't careful, a good philosophical idea can be turned into a terrible investment decision because you don't know the details. And you really don't know how the system functions. And you don't know the interests or the ability to align parties.
Well, Chancellor, I appreciate your presentation. Obviously, your life experiences have contributed to your success. And so I'm going to immediately go to the committee so we can discuss it and possibly move this from committee. But at another venue, you know, there is I'd like to talk to you about the maximum benefit that's in the Constitution that you brought up in your presentation, because there's a debate in the legislature of what the governor and the DNR commissioner did. They changed their mission, and so maybe under another forum we can have that debate. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to close testimony, and we're going to go to the legislation. Let's take care of the amendment first. Representative Keller.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much intend this to be a friendly amendment.
Yes.
And it was something that I would like to make a conceptual amendment instead of the one in front of you. And, you know, but I'm going to have to leave. And but in light of the testimony we just had, I would like to go to page 4, line 5, where before this, I had asked Bob if we could include, or Representative Herron, if we could include private sector job expansion. But after hearing this good testimony and his comprehensive list of goals that we have, it just captured me. And I would like to include then after, after the word generation, comma, private sector job expansion, comma, affordable energy options, comma, and value-added options, comma, and competitiveness. I think it just expands and incorporates the goals that were just comprehensively described to us that struck a note with me. And so, conceptually, if we could do that, that'd be great.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, to this amendment, it sort of goes at the question that I was going to raise, and that is, in light of the testimony today, the aspect of having a trained workforce, having, you know, focusing on really making sure that when we talk about increasing Alaska's jobs, we acknowledge that Norway has a pre-K to PhD free program for their citizens. They're exporting educated people in the industry all over the world and in other fields as well. And I don't see any other element except for this amendment that talks about education. So that's one point. And I think that, you know, it's part of the lesson learned in Norway, and it's part of what we aren't doing. And we have such poor rankings in a host of areas. And so that's one thing. And then on the issue of including the word competitiveness, I would object to that word, not because I don't want us to be competitive, but because it's been co-opted to be sort of a code for reducing taxes on the industry.
Yeah. In light of time, Mr. Chair, that's in the bill already, and I would just soon not go there.
Yeah. Well, I think that, both Brian and Chancellor brought up some good testimony, and the next Northern Waters Task Force needs the room, so we'll just meet with committee members after this meeting, and let's just move this to next week, and then we can have a better dialogue. So I'm going to hold the resolution over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope you're not too disappointed, because I think it's a wonderful resolution, and I've signed on to it, and my intention is not in any way to delay it. But as great as it can be.
No, I recognize that. Is because of the testimony, And then, of course, tonight we're going to have the Arctic Policy Forum. So, you know, for this to be delayed by a meeting so that all members can maybe add something, because we've learned a lot today. So, no, I think it's better that we hold off. So, appreciate the committee's attendance, and to the presenters, we're adjourned at 11:16.